Grace, we're here today to talk about Sakana. You led, along with Brandon here at Lux Capital, a $30 million founding seed round into the company. It's our first big investment into Japan. Well, it's our first investment ever in Japan, so that's very exciting. But there's sort of two questions on my mind. First, why do we need a whole new AI company, one that's focused on other types of large language models? And two, like, why Japan? So maybe we can start with the first.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. We're very excited about Sakana AI and partnering alongside not only David Ha, but also Lion Jones and Ren Ito, the three co-founders. They're just really fantastic. When you think about AI today, AI scientists have made tremendous progress over the last few decades. First, we saw the rise of computer vision and ImageNet. We first partnered with Matt Zeiler of Clarify back in 2013. We saw the GANs, generative adversarial networks, and then the Transformer paper, of course, published by Lion Jones, one of the co-authors, in fact, of Sakana. And now we see Transformers undergirding huge systems. You've seen in tandem with that the scale of not only data, the scale of compute, and the scale of these models themselves. So bigger and bigger models, more and more compute and GPU usage. And it kind of feels like we're scaling with kind of no end in sight at this point. You know, what is the bigger model you can do and the more access you can get and access to GPUs? Sakana is kind of taking a different approach, and it's very actually emblematic of their logo, which is a red fish swimming away from a sea of fish. Sakana is, of course, the Japanese word for fish. And they're thinking, you know, when everyone's looking at scaling and how do we make transformers bigger and models larger and larger, how can we take a different approach? And so they are technically doing things, something quite different. They're actually taking advantage of evolution methods or evolutionary methods of intelligence. So these are collective intelligence models. Simple lay way of saying it is, you know, smaller agent-based models that are working together in cool ways to create more efficient and adaptive models going forward. It dates back to a lot of David's incredible research working on the JAX framework at Google. He actually has a few other folks who have done work on EvoJAX and other really exciting frameworks who have since joined the Sakana team. It also works with a lot of Lion's work on character-based training, which is another key aspect, which is basically how do we train these large language models, not just based on the per word basis, but on a per character basis. So we're leveraging, you know, for example, a Japanese character, kanji, versus, you know, a word, and how can we train models that are specialized for that language specifically. So they're really looking bigger picture with Sakana of how do we do models that are simpler, more efficient, and also, you know, going to achieve the same result with these nature-inspired methods versus trying to, you know, raise hundreds of millions of dollars for compute and scale the biggest model possible.
And I think it's amazing because the symbology of the fish, this idea of a school of fish coming together, all swimming in the same direction, creating a path forward, I think kind of encapsulates the thesis here. But one of the most interesting facts about this company is David was at Google, Lion was at Google, and yet they're in the center of Tokyo, Japan. How did that happen, and why are we making our first investment here in Japan with Sakana?
Well, Japan's a really interesting place. My fun fact is I actually spent part of my childhood in Japan as an expat, and it's a really special place for those who have visited. Not only is the technical infrastructure amazing, where you can hop on bullet trains, the subway is spotless. It's really a culture where people are taking care of each other. I remember walking around when I was 10 years old, you know, alone, and everyone was looking out for you. You see, you know, a three-year-old on the subway where everyone was looking out for them. And it's really this really beautiful culture that I encourage, you know, everyone to go and visit, combined with huge early adopters of technology. I believe they're one of the first international markets to adopt Twitter. Over 50% of the population uses it today. Think of all the cool innovations that have come out of Japan, whether it's, you know, the Sony Walkman or it's the bullet train, the LED light, lithium ion batteries, huge robotics and humanoid robot adopters as well. So they're really a huge innovation culture and economy and early adopter of that. Fast forward to kind of David and Lion stories. They came to Japan in kind of unique ways. David moved there for a Goldman Sachs in the derivative trading division, right, and was working there. He's not Japanese by background either. He actually was studying in Toronto prior to that. Lion came because he was looking for somewhere else to move in Google's office and had a great vacation in Japan and never came back. Japan has a great way of attracting folks to it and also keeping them there, just as, you know, whether you're an expat or whether you're someone visiting, because it has a very unique culture that I mentioned.
Well, and we've just seen the government of Japan just introduce a digital nomad visa in the last 2 weeks since we recorded this. Obviously, the company has attracted an enormous number of candidates, both locally and domestically from University of Tokyo and a lot of great research labs, but also internationally. A lot of folks who want to work on the frontier of AI and LLMs, but also would like to do that in an amazing city like Tokyo. And so bringing those talent pools together, bringing the fish all into one school is sort of an amazing story. We've got David on the line. We are actually recording this about 12 hours after talking to David because we were on a different time zone. And so let's dive into our conversation with David, his story, background, and what he's building with Sakana now.
Are we recording? Oh, wow. Oh, amazing. Wow. That was a sudden, like, we're live. Did you know this is a live show, David? We're broadcasting live on YouTube right now. No, not really. Don't, cool, don't freak out. I don't know if that joke works better in the morning or late at night, but it's so great to have you on the show. I mean, I want to dive in because I think you are an extremely rare person who was on the rarefied track of investment banking and the IB world, derivatives trading, popular place, doing complex mathematics. But then at the same side, you had this sort of shadow career, shadow life where you had an anonymous blog and not the kind of Wall Street Oasis anonymous blog complaining about your colleagues, but you actually did productive things. How did this come around and why did you kind of build this outlet?
I'll give you a background. I studied engineering science at University of Toronto. And when I graduated, it was still a few years after the dot-com crash. So it's quite a long time ago. Maybe many people don't remember the dot-com crash now. It was pretty hard to get technical jobs. And what I worked on as an undergrad was on things like control systems, signals and analysis, and even neural networks. So my lab was quite close to Jeff Hinton's back then, when no one cared about Jeff Hinton right. and neural networks. It was during the neural network winter. So at the time, I was hanging out in the library, and I discovered some cool math books, and one of them was a book on derivatives pricing. So that led me to get into the world of, you know, finance, quantitative finance. It was the business section, and there was like in the appendix there was C++ code. So I thought it was kind of cool. it was kind of a cool concept for me. Luckily at U of T, there were a few other profs. There's a professor called John Ho and Alan White. So they wrote the book Options, Futures, and Other Derivatives. It's one of the Bibles, and I audited their class. As an undergrad, they had an MBA class. So I went through all of their exercises, you know, sat into their MBA class, and they let me. And then, you know, that was basically how I got into Wall Street.
Now, I have to point out how crazy this is. I mean, Grace and I both went to Stanford, but very different times. I was there during the Great Financial Crisis. At least at Stanford at the time, it was the people who wanted to go into investment banking whose careers got completely waylaid, right? No one got a job. Goldman didn't come. I mean, it's hard to believe, but the big banks, the big consulting firms were gone. They didn't show up. And the only thing you could do in 2008 was to join app companies. It was basically the App Store was coming. Apple just released the iPhone. And so everyone got waylaid from economics. And the smart people ended up doing ad sales. They actually went into ads when the mobile networks had just gotten started. You did the exact opposite course, which I have to find is sort of funny to me and maybe apropos to Sakana and the whole kind of way you're building the company. But you went into finance during the Great Financial Crisis when no one else was able to sort of break in.
It was crazy. It's kind of like swimming the opposite tide from my class, if anything. I kind of liked it too at the beginning. It was interesting. It taught me many concepts like, you know, probability distributions applied to the real world. As a practitioner in finance, as an options trader, you really learn about how the math doesn't work, you know, especially into the financial right. crisis. I think that's one of the things that many academics, especially in machine learning, might not appreciate when you have all the theory, you have tail distributions, you even have the so-called real-world distributions in the data set. But whenever you deploy stuff in the real world, it'll never behave the way that you intended it to behave. And I think this is why I think, you know, understanding these concepts, complex systems, dynamical systems, was kind of an important part of my education in finance. The whole school of academics that are taught to understand like the efficient market hypothesis, everything's like a nice behaved Gaussian distribution and a random walk. Maybe that might work for like an individual stock trader or an individual investor. As a trader at a company like Goldman or any, you know, large institution, the price, the trajectory of the asset price is directly a function of what the participant does. So also on one day, if I decided to through some, you know, customer or through my own strategy, buy or sell certain bonds, then that would move the price. And that might actually, through some butterfly effect, change the trajectory of the price 15 years later. It's kind of like I dive into an appreciation of the works of George Soros. So he was a proponent of something called the reflexivity theory. It's like the rather than the price is a reflection of the world is a reflection of the price. Therefore, you know, the price actually affects how the behaviors in the real world, and hence there's a positive feedback loop that can happen. You know, in finance, if you know, that was how he triggered the, you know, like how the Bank of England had to change the policy, you know, because of his price action. I mean, he claims that it's going to happen anyway, and he accelerated it. But you know, regardless of what happened, it does show that this is related to machine learning in a sense as well. It shows the environment is actually shaped by the actions of its agents. So right now in the machine learning world, you have like the data sets and the benchmarks. So here's the ImageNet data set, and you train a model to get a high score on the validation set, or you have some reinforcement learning environment and you train the agents to play that game. But in the real world, the line between the environment and the agents is very blurry. In some ways, the environment is part of the agents and the agent is part of the environment. And I think these are kind of the themes that I'm interested in as a AI researcher. It's like rather than, you know, training a state-of-the-art model to do some particular task, you want to look at the intricacies of how these models interact with their environment and with each other.
I think what you're getting at is sort of the core philosophical divide in statistics. When you're talking about frequentism and frequentists, you know, you have a data generating process, you have this collection of data, you have an ideal model, and you're trying to find which model sort of matches, which ideal model matches the data, right? So when you're trying to match to an ImageNet benchmark or any benchmark, you collect models, you have 50, let's say, you run them, you backtest them, and you're like, this is the model. This one is the best, this is the most accurate. And it seems to me like you're much more of a Bayesianist. You're coming at it from, I don't know anything about the world. I have some prior knowledge, but I'm open-ended to how all the intricacies, all the complexities work together. I have to see what emerges out of the system, and I will, you know, sort of mold the model to kind of fit the world as it is, not the world as I wish it was.
Much of my thinking and how I approached this subject was also studying some of the work of the Bayesian probability theory. Not just in finance, you know, reading the likes of, you know, basically you can't really predict anything. It's all Bayesian. But in machine learning, if I recommend like one textbook that everyone should read, it's one of those timeless textbooks, and it's written by Chris Bishop. It's called Machine Learning Probabilistic Models. And I think that was when I picked up some of the basics about how to think in a Bayesian framework. And actually, that was one of the early books that I had the opportunity to study during lunch, you know, when I was working at a Goldman Sachs as a trader. Because luckily, I was in the Japan office and you have really long lunches. So I was...
Like, I don't think there's a quality most people associate with Japan or East Asia. Yeah, is very long, yeah. Three martini lunches at the office.
It's true. I think people would go, you know, have lunch, or in the old days, like before my time, it's not allowed now, but they probably go drink and smoke with their brokers and, you know, talk yes. about stuff. I thought I was going to come here to stay for 2 years because I liked anime and stuff, but ended up staying for like 10 years. I worked in a tower called Roppongi Hills.
Yeah, of course.
I after buying lunch there for 2 years, you save up lots of points. They have this little point card. Japan loves points cards. And what I discovered was I can use that point card and gain access to the Roppongi Hills like library. So it's right in the same building above the Goldman trading floor. There's like this private library. And I could access it for free because I did lots of like lunch buying over 2 years. So every day at lunch, I would go to the library. Now, I read up on machine learning. I also read up on many papers about evolution. You know, some of the papers written by folks like Ken Stanley and you know, about the theories of open-endedness, about meta-learning. And some of these things, you know, I thought it was better to learn concepts and try to build something rather than just read books and read papers. So I'm kind of like, you know, learn it by building. So what I ended up doing was I created, you know, I like this simple language called JavaScript because, you know, you don't really need a compiler. You just need a laptop and a text editor and it'll run in your browser. And it was like, you know, it kind of looked like C, which I learned in school. And it's a bit messy. So I ended up implementing many machine learning experiments in JavaScript. And one of the benefits of JavaScript is you can actually, you know, play around with the models on your browser. So it was easy to create like these demos where I can test my results interactively. So I think, you know, some of my earlier works, it was really interactive machine learning based. So many people publish papers, but I like to publish, you know, kind of like paper, but also have an interactive version of the paper that people can interact, like, you know, play around with.
Well, and I will say, when you think about that era, and even to the present day in computer science, is typically the conference paper. You go to a big conference, you know, NeurIPS, I know a bunch of us just went to down in New Orleans, hopefully Vancouver next year. And the idea is this big poster and you get a poster award, et cetera. And it's always so sad to me because on one hand, it's great that we're making these theoretical contributions and people have good work. But computer science is so experimental. You can actually write the code. You can actually play with it. You actually have this artifact you can do something with. And yet we kind of print it out and you know, paste it to a you know, piece of corkboard and off we go, as opposed to something that people can actually use and demonstrate something in their browser, whatever the case may be.
There's a kind of a deeper implications of this as well. Like when you're kind of like presenting your research as something that people can play with, it's much more impactful than just having a paper with a table one, your figures and your results on some benchmarks. No. Because people can actually identify holes in your approach, which the researcher might not like, but it's actually important. Yeah, the people can find, you know, funny examples, post it on Twitter and have it become right. Viral. It also allows people to fork the approach and, you know, like extend it. So I think an extension of this interactive ML phenomenon, I think it kind of died down, but it got replaced by the current open source phenomenon. So people can kind of, okay, here's something cool I did. You know, I randomly interpolated the weights of two stable diffusion models and I merged them. It doesn't make any sense, but the results look really cool. You know, here's the model and they, right. They post it on Hugging Face. And now that's the birth of the concept called model merging and other people take over. So I think getting the hands dirty and building stuff is a lot more important than presenting the results on the tabular formats.
And this is sort of the tension between mathematics and the elegance of, you know, formulas and writing out a proof. And then at the end, you're done QED with engineering. And the idea of engineering is there's never kind of a done point of engineering, right? You have these demos, you play with them, you can obviously optimize them, you can make them better. You could do that for the rest of your life and never get to sort of the end. As we see all the time in artificial intelligence. So it's very different. But I do want to go back. So, I mean, you were in Roppongi Hills, you're a Goldman, you're doing derivatives trading, you're getting these long Japanese-style lunches, and you're in the library. Where did the idea for an anonymous blog come from for all these different hacks and experiments you were sort of playing with?
Yeah, I kind of kept a diary of what I was learning and post some of my results online. I had like a GitHub account, but I also want to write up some of the projects and get people to play around with it. But I really can't share it under my real name. Living in Japan, I like eating sushi, so I call my blog otoro.net under the tuna name. I put some of my experiments there. And then, yeah, some of them became popular. Like, I think as a researcher, getting feedback from audience is important. You know, you post some model, people can play around with it and tell you what works and what doesn't work. So it's kind of like how do you say, Instagram for researchers in a sense. Like you kind of count the feedback of yes. what you're doing, right? Yeah. So you post something and see if it organically, you know, has any impact. If people like it or if people don't like it, maybe you can kind of tweak your approach to find more interesting. So I was more going about this thing of pursuit of novelty, like pursuing novel, interesting things. As someone with a MacBook, and in the library, you can't beat ImageNet or C4.10. Like you can kind of create some virtual creatures that battle each other, right? But you can't really like beat state of the art. So I was more, you know, my whole machine learning education was about pursuing interestingness, doing things that haven't really been done before. And I think looking back, if we look at the education of the machine learning researcher, I call this kind of like the tiger mom theory. So you have like a cohort of, you know, educated people who wants to achieve the highest grades, and they finally get into like, you know, the MIT undergrad. And after that, they want to work for all the right profs and then get into the right grad school. Then the metric is, you know, producing the most papers and, you know, the most citations and so on. So I think this culture might actually kind of explain how we got to where we are now. Though we have this kind of a culture of chasing high benchmarks, larger model sizes, you know, improved state of the art. It's important though. I think we need this in a sense, because like if you add up a million incremental improvements, you get breakthroughs. So that's one side of how technology develops. But you also need the other side. You know, you need, you know, people that just, you know, think of some wacky new ideas that was never meant to work. Fast forward a few years, look at it now again in this open source or weird foundation model world. You know, you find a lot of these breakthroughs are not happening at labs. Like it's like some hobbyists that are doing some cool stuff with you know, like hacking on some other people's models, and they discover cool concepts that people at labs might not discover themselves. So you have this kind of a, right now it's kind of like a cyberpunk mentality. You have all these like complicated big models, and you have the hackers. So it's the hackers versus the academics, I think. So I think the hackers are important.
I think what you're getting at is, you know, this is sort of fertile territory. You can do whatever you want. You can experiment, you can hack. And when you go to academia, unfortunately, the pathways are very strict, right? Like there are a couple of conferences you must present. To have a paper that is accepted to one of these conferences, it has to meet a certain bar. Those bars are determined by panels of judges, which are very constrained. You can't just show a little demo and be like, look at this, I'll post it to a post board or whatever. And so, you know, and unfortunately, what those careers are so long, as you were pointing out, from undergrad into graduate school into postdocs into a professorship. And at any point, if you sort of give it up, if you start to experiment or be a rebel, you're sort of off track. Like there's kind of no way back on. It's very competitive. There are very few slots, and it winnows all the way through. And so in some ways, it shouldn't surprise us that a career path, which is built on follow the herd, or in your case, or more apropos, a school of fish all going in the same way, each salmon being caught by the bear as they're going upstream against a very, very strong current upstream, you know, being the fish that kind of doesn't follow along in the same path, maybe the best way to find something new on the edge of what's possible. And so I'm not surprised that we're seeing in the decentralized kind of open source communities way more innovation than in some of these AI cathedral hubs at major universities.
Yeah, it's true. And also, you know, the weird thing about your point is at some point in academia, when you actually, the light at the end of the tunnel is tenure, where you're supposed to have the freedom.
Now you're free. You're free to do whatever you want.
And you see, you do no see one believes profs that can do it, right? But the reality is many profs, you know, at that stage of their life might not become so free. Although some profs I know are quite, you know, innovative once they get tenure. Or at least close to tenure. So I think it's some people still, you know, take advantage of that. But, you know, surprisingly, not so many.
Well, it's a selection effect, right? I mean, if you made it all the way there, there's some folks who still have the little pilot light that's ready to spark. That as soon as they get the tenure, you know, offer, they're able to be like, everything's going away. All the useless papers are done. This part of my career is over. Now I have 20 brilliant ideas I'm ready to actually go do. But, you know, the great part about, I think, AI, engineering, computer science in general, unlike many other fields, like you go to biology, as much as there's democratization, most of the democratization is coming from AI. But unfortunately, the reality is that you need a lab. It takes hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, to get going. You're not going to get a lab until your 40s. It takes a really, really long time to kind of get going and be able to do original science. What's amazing with computer science is you can do it in high school. You can be a middle schooler. You can download anything from Hugging Face. You can be part of this community. You can hack. You can distribute this on Twitter and be taken seriously, particularly as you pointed out with your viral blog. You know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people can look at this and realize immediately that you've done something original. And they don't even know who you are. I mean, it's a little bit like that New Yorker cartoon of the dog on the internet. And they're like, you know, on the internet, no one knows that I'm a dog. But, you know, you could otherwise have been trapped. I mean, I just think of it as the internet here is so revolutionary for you, because otherwise you would have been trapped in Roppongi in the 1980s. I think Roppongi Hills probably got built in the 90s. So I'm making this up. Sequestered in a library, reading a textbook, coming up with brilliant ideas, it would just be lost to history. But instead you had this platform and medium that allowed you to distribute those ideas, get them in front of the faces of really brilliant, smart people, and have the world kind of delectably enjoy the work that you were building.
It was really delightful, you know. It's also really delightful to me to stand on the shoulders of giants as well. Reading some of the old papers by Ken Stanley on things it's called a morphology search, and now it's called architecture search. So one of the blog posts I did was to extend Ken's idea on neural network morphology search, but incorporate backprop to it so you can fine-tune the weights in real time. It's kind of simple, but you can kind of make an interactive demo. And I think that work and a few other works, you know, what became popular with a few folks at Google. So Jeff Dean reached out to me with regards to the architecture search work, that blog post. And my previous colleague and manager and mentor, So Doug Eck reached out to me with regards to some of the other creative machine learning experiments. They encouraged the anonymous me to, hey, whoever you are, you should try to apply to become a researcher at Google. They had a Google Brain residency program that was opening up in 2016. And they were looking to get that program to attract non-typical PhD folks or a mix of folks. I went for that and I got a job at Google. So I moved to California. And I had the best experience of my life. I never regret joining Google. I think it's the best place. Especially the batch in that first batch of the Google Brain residency was filled with amazing people. We had people like a Peter Thiel scholar.
The batch I was in was the best batch of all time.
Yeah.
It's only been downhill since then.
I think you got a few good years. I think, yeah, you got a few good years. It was pretty good.
I was a part of the APM intern way back in the day, but it was a similar notion when the APM program just got started, right? When Google initiated one of these new ideas, you know, there's all these folks who, plus or minus 2-3 years, were like the right folks. You had a couple of slots, and all of a sudden you're bringing this amazing cohort together that should have known each other all along. But it took Google building a little program to get going. And then the pipeline of talent changes. You know, you have this huge wave and then it sort of resets a little bit and becomes kind of normal. But it's that first group in a lot of these programs that, you know, it's like a sucking sound from the market, but you suddenly had all these people who knew that they needed to know each other. And it takes, you know, a program to bring them together.
I mean, I'm in a really privileged position to say this, but I would pay money to be in the Google Brain residency program. It's kind of like going to grad school. You just bounce around so many ideas. And I joined projects that resonated with me. So my mentor, Doug Eck, he started a project called Magenta. So it was about applying machine learning to creativity. And that had a big impact in my research. Making interactive demos, making machine learning being used in real time by the audience. And I had the opportunity to move to Japan again in 2018. So around that time, Google built this gigantic building in Shibuya District in Japan.
It's very pretty. Campus.
It's awesome. Yeah.
I had a good sushi there. Probably similar, maybe not the Roppongi Hills sushi option, but it was really quite incredible.
No, yeah, it's incredible. 35 floors. Now, I guess, you know, this is a theme that we might come back to later again, but maybe I figure maybe because from Google's point of view, the China market didn't really work out. And my guess is Japan's a great market. You know, YouTube has its own culture in Japan. There's VTubers,
yes.
Right? There's people who do cosplay on YouTube, and there's a whole like Japan YouTube is very different than YouTube. So, and ads is also phenomenal in Japan. So I think they invested in Japan. And I was a bunch of us who, like people at Google Research who were interested to move to Japan, we got together and we wrote like a, well, as a Googlers, we wrote a design doc. we wrote like a the four pager to explain, well, hey, why you should let us go to Japan, and it got approved. So I was one of the first research folks from the brain team to move to Japan, along with other folks like Heiga Zen from the speech team, and so on. So I started a really small team in the Shibuya office, leading the Google Brain research team. There are other teams as well. Like there's the translation NLP teams that were already there. So we're not the first researchers, but I think the Google Brain research team, we were the first folks establishing a team there. And then I worked on more the wacky ideas like a neural network evolution, collective systems, you know, scaling up evolution, and working on more of the creativity machine learning angle for another 2 to 3 years. So that was basically my Google career. So I ended up working at Google for, you know, six and a half years, yeah, before venturing, you know, in into now like the startup space. So that was a fun ride.
And so, I mean, you're based in, let's go up to the present day. So, I mean, you're based in Shibuya, or at least Tokyo. I don't actually know.
Tokyo, yeah.
Yeah. but you sort of built out Sakana, focused on heterogeneous, natural-inspired AI models. Just raised $30 million founding seed round from us and a bunch of our friends here at Lux. I'm curious because you had this amazing experience at Google, a company that gets hit pretty hard in the news these days, both on the financial side, but among employees, that the company's culture has changed a lot. It's less inventive. It's harder to get projects and products underway. I have to admit that I was there 12 years ago, and it was pretty hard to get a product launched back then, too. So I always feel like the grass is always greener in a different history era. But I'm curious, as you're starting to think about building Sakana, you know, you have this theme of a fish kind of going against the stream, against the other school of fish going in the same direction. How do you sort of build a culture that allows for creativity, innovation, this sort of hacking mentality, all the personality that you just described and the experiences you just had? How do you think about building that for all these new employees? Because you're already attracting a great cohort and cross-section of Japan talent, global talent, all looking to descend on Tokyo. How do you stitch that together?
There's a few parts. The first comment I want to make is I think, you know, Googlers are still very creative. I think, you know, it's with these waves of technology, you always have, you know, as my co-founder Lion Jones likes to say, you have the wave of exploration and exploitation and exploration and exploitation. So Google is pretty good at the exploration phase. And I think it takes some time to get together when you're a company of 100,000 people, you're navigating an aircraft carrier. So it takes them a little bit more time to change direction to go to the exploitation phase. Right. So I don't know. I'm still rooting for Google. I think they've recently shown some good progress on Gemini. You know, you've seen some of the recent benchmarks. My favorite benchmark is the chatbot arena. So when you have two chatbots enter and one chatbot leaves, so that, they actually, you know, you can't really cheat that. It's a human evaluation, and they were able to achieve quite good scores. So I think having them improve is actually good for everyone. It kind of maybe, it might give OpenAI some pressure as well to move forward. So I think, you know, it's always a good thing. But getting to the other question now, how do we encourage innovation? I mean, I don't know the perfect answer to that. Otherwise, it would be fantastic. But some of the principles I use for innovation is to enforce constraints on resources. But imagine on day one, we spent all $30 million. And, you know, we signed up for, like, you know, lock us in for 3 years of compute with Google Cloud, right? And we suddenly have like this massive TPU pods that at our disposal. The type of work we do would be very different. Like, we'll be like, okay, every minute I'm not using this compute, like the clock is ticking, then I'm wasting my resources. So we're going to be naturally figuring out how to train the model that would use all of these resources. It's more like an engineering type problem. The other approach is, I don't know, maybe you see someone on some of my Twitter feed is, what the first thing I did was I bought a few workstations, and each of them have like, you know, two GPUs. And you know, the researcher is okay. This is what you get to experiment with, to play around with, and so keep ourselves a bit GPU poor.
Well, I think it's when you think about what the next generation of AI technologies is to come. A lot of it is about, you know, on device, particularly mobile device. Can I actually run the entire, you know, neural net on an iPhone? And you can't today. It's too big. It has to be in the cloud. The costs are extremely high. We've seen numbers from Anthropic and I believe OpenAI as well. The gross margins are actually quite bad on AI companies. Every query is very expensive. It's unprofitable. And so at some point, these curves have to change, which means we have to get much more efficient with the ability to both train a model as well as execute against it. And you know, if you have hundreds of millions of dollars in compute credits, there's really no incentive to try to get better at this. Like, you know, you're not sort of limited by that factor. And so engineers are smart people. They're like, okay, if I can use, you know, 10,000 H100, you know, chips, let's just go do that. Why would I not? I have all the compute power in the world. It's amazing, you know, Terminator style. But I think what you're getting at is a classic, you know, push for innovation, which is the constraint, which is if you want engineers to, you know, get more creative, to really rethink solutions and to get out of their paradigms and their ideologies, they need a constraint that says, look, you can't do the thing that's in the paper because that's a $1 billion to train that model. You've got $1 million. Okay. And I think I'm forgetting all the computer science laws, but is it Hofstadter's law that says that if any input changes by 10x, you have to rewrite the system? Well, it works in reverse, right? If the input gets, you know, cut by 90%, so you have to go to a tenth of what you had before, it's decimated, if you will. Suddenly you have to rethink the whole model. Okay, my memory went from a gigabyte to 128, you know, megabytes. I have to rethink of the way I code. I have to rethink of efficiencies. I have to track my pointers much better than I did the first time. I can't allocate everything. And so I think setting that up right from the beginning is super interesting because it sets you up for this course of finding new solutions. And I will say, to connect it into, you know, my little world of policy, I always try to remind folks in DC, every time you kind of cut off China or other countries from certain types of chips, you know, you're actually just offering them new constraints. And you don't actually know whether that actually harms or actually helps, because by distending them from all this compute, you might actually encourage them to find new solutions, and they might actually have better models in a couple of years than you otherwise realize unintentionally based on this policy. And that gets back at our early part of the conversation around complexity, which is sometimes, you know, the butterfly effect. Okay, we put in a license, you can't buy an H100. Well, now I don't need it at all. Now I don't even have to buy it because I've come up with something better that uses easier and cheaper chips. And I've come out to a much more efficient, you know, outcome. Who would have thought that all the way from the beginning of this whole process?
100%. I agree with that. I think, you know, the founder of Lux, one of the co-founders, Josh, is also, you know, like has interesting views on geopolitics as well. Some of them.
Yes, interesting. With. Yes.
Yeah. Like especially the complex systems of trade. Like if you limit, say, China's ability to buy GPUs, like they will come up with their own better version of the GPU, better in their own way. So I think, you know, the policy folks have to think harder.
You know, I always joke, but it's like, it's always, I wrote a piece a year ago and I won't get distracted with this. Great Grace is here, but is scared and like looking at like, don't go that direction. But I will say I do enjoy how much that the US focuses on restrictions, blocking your access to technology. Whereas from China's perspective, China always goes the other direction. It just dumps. It dumps solar panels. It's dumping electric vehicles now in Europe. There's a huge crisis because Europe is swarming with EVs. In fact, China, as we're recording this week, took over from Japan on EV and overall auto exports for the first time ever. And it's because they have cheap EVs. And so now you have no domestic industry and there's no incentive to get better at it because you're like, well, I can buy it so cheaply. It's just coming over the border. Why would I build out my own capability? And I always find this dichotomy so fascinating. But let's go to one final question, because I know it's very late in Japan. But you have lived in Japan for a long time. You've had careers there, Goldman, Google, now Sakana as CEO and running your own company. What is the most interesting attraction for building a company in Japan? Why there when everyone else is going to Silicon Valley, to Cerebral Valley, as Hayes Valley is called? And I always have to say, like, from a branding perspective, brilliant, because I love Hayes Valley. It's a very nice neighborhood. But it is small. You can walk Hayes Valley in about 4 minutes. And to think that it's supposed to be the hub of all AI in the world is a little frightening to me. But why Tokyo?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you know, I can list so many reasons, but like, at the end of the day, it's a place that I love. I love the food here, to be honest. I love sushi. So, like, I think for me and my co-founders, it's not a choice for us to start the company here. This is the place that's, you know, where we've grown accustomed to living in, a place that we call home. But when we did the analysis, you know, okay, then the decision is, should we stay and start a company in Japan, or should we say move to the Bay Area to start a company? So then if I frame it that way, then it kind of makes more sense, where if I go to the Bay Area to start a company, there's suddenly, you know, 200 other competitors full of like ex Google Brain residency people like starting their own companies like that I would like compete directly with, whereas in Japan there is like many good AI companies here, but there's more room to achieve an impact here. So it's like it's less crowded. I think also it feels like, you know, Tokyo as a city, it's not like tech hub. It's like there's banks, there's fashion companies, there's creative industries. So there's a whole mix of people. Even the foreigner, the non-Japanese people working here now, it's a really good diverse crowd of like chefs to you know, web developers, to you know, the even lawyers, the typical bankers, but also artists, you know, sports people. So for me as a researcher, I got all of my ideas when I was working and traveling and living in Japan. Even when I was at Google, many of my ideas were formulated when I was, you know, living in Japan. You know, it was presented when I was working at Google and refined. So I think there's a certain element of life here that allows me to have some innovation. There are some examples of that, like the fact that, you know, there's like, you know, the 8-hour time difference away from the Bay Area means that, you know, during Google times, there's always like, I don't have to go to all these meetings, right? You have your own time to right. develop your own stuff. So this sort of space is also the reason why Japan develops its own weird tech that's different than the rest of the world. From a business point of view, recruiting is actually surprisingly easier than I thought.
Poppy didn't hear. The very fact that Sakana is not in Silicon Valley is one of the most unique things about it, right, in our mind. And the strong history of technological innovation, right, stable democracy, and top 5 global economy, like, it's just, there's a really unique experiment of ingredients where, to David's point, there's also a talent arbitrage where he can get a ton of amazing talent and be that, like, regional hub. We often, you know, analogize it to, you know, the DeepMind equivalent for Asia, and a great place to attract expats to live, you know, in Tokyo itself.
I think it just is such an attractive place. I spent 6 weeks in Tokyo in the last year, mostly in Shibuya, but all across Japan. Why I was at the Google building, I mean, it's just down the street. It's amazing to see this obelisk of technology. But I think what's so attractive is people would love to live there. And it seems like there's this barrier to say, like, I don't want to work for NTT. I don't want to work for a large conglomerate like Toshiba or Sony or any of these sort of classic Japanese companies. I want to work for the edge, something innovative. And that's always been a little bit of a divide. The startup ecosystem has always been sort of underdeveloped for Japan's kind of success on the economy side. And so I think you are one of these great bridges where, you know, I can either work for Google or one or two other companies. Twitter, I think, has an office there. But now there are these great startups where there is a agglomeration of talent. There's really smart people building up. It's innovative. It's kind of a hacker mentality. It's, you're kind of getting the best of both worlds. And I just think that's extremely rare. And for a certain type of person, like, look, it's not going to be attractive to everyone, but for a certain type of person, that is the world's best place to be. But David, I know we've kept you way past your bedtime. Normally you're in bed by 7 p.m. and it is 11:30 your time. And I want to be appreciative of the time. So David Haw, CEO and founder of Sakana AI, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.